Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungain, RTE's deputy foreign editor, also in Brussels. We're here on day two of the EU summit that was supposed not to be about Brexit, but reporters and Leo Varadkar just couldn't resist.
We'll hear more from the Taoiseach's interventions on Brexit a bit later, and as the Tory leadership race is reduced down to two, we'll assess what Prime Minister Boris Johnson's first moves might be on the off chance he is elected and when they might be taken.
And we'll assess whether the EU might be in any mood to give the new leader a helping hand.
And what part will the fabled alternative arrangements have in any potential breakthrough? We'll be sorting out the unicorns from the authorised economic operators.
And in a timely manner that the Irish border is not just about tariffs and live animal checks. The European Commission and the UK both published their respective reports on the so-called mapping exercise, the huge trawl of what North-South cooperation means, which was in fact instrumental in how the backstop evolved. But first, here we are at the summit, not Theresa May's last, as it was being touted, but nearly her last, Tony.
That's right, Colm. Theresa May was thought to be here on her last summit because, though, EU leaders have failed to appoint the next president of the European Commission or any of the other top jobs, then they're going to have to come back here next Sunday, June the 30th, to try and get those positions filled, or at least the European Commission President Commission filled. And so Theresa May is going to have to come back for one last time. But it was really supposed to be a summit where the EU was demonstrating that it had other fish to fry, other business at hand. So Brexit was only given a 5-minute or 10-minute cursory mention near the end of day two, today's day two of the EU summit. But of course, having said that, though, everyone was quite keen to hear from the leaders as they arrived about what they thought of the Tory leadership contest, what they would make of a Boris Johnson premiership, should that happen. And of course, Leo Varadkar in particular was the focus of some attention on the current rhetoric of the Tory party leadership race, especially stuff about a time limit to the backstop, alternative arrangements, and also this idea that Boris Johnson or whoever would start by going around the different capitals, trying to pick off one leader after another, and then turn up in Dublin to put some pressure on the Taoiseach, saying he had cooked up a compromise with the other leaders and that something had to be done about the backstop. Otherwise, we'd all be heading for no deal. We can hear now how Leo Varadkar handled those particular questions when he was here on the first day of the summit. He was first of all coming out of the European People's Party pre-summit gathering. You can hear of him talking there, and then on what he said when he arrived at the summit at around 3 o'clock on day one of that meeting.
But in terms of our position, we're being absolutely upfront and clear on this. There's going to be ongoing European unity. Any negotiations will have to happen between the UK and the EU. We're not going to allow the United Kingdom to tour the capitals and try to engage in bilateral agreements. That's not how this works. The withdrawal agreement is not going to be reopened, but we will consider amendments to the joint political declaration. If there is no withdrawal agreement, then there'll be no transition period for the UK.
How realistic would you say the engagement of the various candidates for the leadership of the Conservative Party has been so far with respect to attempts or a desire to change the withdrawal agreement?
Well, you know, there's a campaign underway. It's an internal party conference contest involving MPs and also involving members of the party. But once that's over, whoever wins is going to become British Prime Minister, and they're going to have to face the reality of the situation, a united Europe, a withdrawal agreement that isn't going to be reopened, and a basic fact that if we don't have an agreement by the 31st of October, there won't be an extension other than for a referendum or an election. And if there's a hard deal, no deal Brexit, there'll be no transition period for the UK.
There's very much a strong view across the European Union that there shouldn't be any more extensions. While I have endless patience, some of my colleagues have lost patience, quite frankly, with the UK, and there's enormous hostility to any further extension. So I think an extension could really only happen if it were to facilitate something like a general election in the UK, or perhaps even something like a second referendum if they decided to have one. What won't be entertained is an extension for further negotiations or further indicative votes. That's, you know, the time for that has long since passed.
So as the summit went on at the various arrivals and press conferences and Leo Varadkar's post-summit press conference, and Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker speaking as well, this wasn't a solo run by Leo Varadkar. This was the European position. They couldn't unite on much else over the last 2 days, but Brexit was one thing they were singing off the same hymn sheet on.
Yeah, I mean, even though they decided only to make Brexit what they call an info point, not a machine in a busy high street, it is actually a short explanation by Jean-Claude Juncker and Donald Tusk of what's happening on no-deal planning and so on. But they were at pains to stress that they all had unanimously agreed around the table that there would be no reopening of the withdrawal agreement, that they would, of course, want to embark on a cordial relationship with the new British Prime Minister, and they would enter talks with him, but that did not include any sense of reopening the withdrawal agreement. I think this comes in the light of what you would call a kind of a feedback loop between Westminster, the Tory party, and the EU, because there have been reports, particularly in the British press, about signs and signals that the EU would, in order to avoid a calamitous no deal, would do something for the new Prime Minister, that they would be prepared to look again at the backstop at the withdrawal agreement, even though they've been making public protestations that that wasn't going to be possible. And you've heard some of the candidates, particularly Jeremy Hunt, who said he'd heard from both Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron that they wanted to look again at the withdrawal agreement. But when these pronouncements are made, I do my best here in Brussels to contact as many people as possible to see where this is coming from. And the eventual theory is that some of this stuff comes from either advisors to the lead candidates in the Tory race, or officials in the UK who have their own ideas about how to fix the backstop, and those ideas then are mediated over to diplomats and officials here in Brussels, not officially, and then in turn that stuff echoes back to London. For example, it has been reported that the EU was considering somehow phasing in alternative arrangements to the backstop, in other words, technology, other exemptions and so on. We can get into that a bit later. And as they phase in those things, then the backstop would be phased out. So in other words, as one chunk of alternative arrangements were agreed by both sides, then one bit of the backstop would fall away. Now, this has been flatly rejected by the Irish government and dismissed out of hand, but it is indicative of this weird echo chamber between Brussels and London, because the fact of the matter is the EU is not in any sense discussing either formally or informally any of these ideas. And the other thing is that,
well, the ideas themselves, even if there was a value to them, or these technical arrangements could be workable, it's unlikely they'd be tested before the 31st of October, was the point that Leo Varadkar was making at his press conference about an hour ago as we speak on lunchtime on Friday, that even if these alternative arrangements do exist, they're not going to be anywhere near completion on time by the 31st of October if they were ever to be ultimately accepted.
Yeah, and I think this is an important point, that even hypothetically, if the EU does agree some convincing new plan with Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt that commands the support of the House of Commons, it wouldn't be done in time for the withdrawal, for the Article 50 extension date of October 31st. Here in Brussels, people assume it would take 2 or 3 months for the process to go through the House of Commons. But another point is that, because of the busy ecosphere of policy and politics and conferences and EU meetings and so on, of course, British officials, British politicians run into their European counterparts and stuff gets said in private conversations. And these musings then make it back into the Tory party leadership race. But the way it was described to me was that, when the EU actually sits down formally to get to grips on a Brexit issue, the group dynamic is different and they tend to be a lot more hardline when it comes to actually making a decision on any of the key elements of the withdrawal agreement. So I think what we had today was a fairly blunt reminder from Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker and Angela Merkel and the Taoiseach as well, that there would be no reopening of the withdrawal agreement and it would really be up to Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt, of course, to figure out what their plan is once they get elected and then when they decide to come to Brussels.
And we had in a version of Europe going to London in the form of Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, giving an interview during the week to the BBC in which he made a lot of these points fairly forcefully, it was interpreted in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Rutte is a very interesting character in this drama because, of course, he's a very good communicator in English. The Netherlands has been seen as a kindred spirit to the UK. It's a very successful, open, free-trading global economy, and they have been on the same page as the UK on a lot of issues. Yet, at the same time, the Netherlands does face serious disruption. It has major trade exposure to the UK, and so it has a vested interest in avoiding a no-deal Brexit. But Mark Rutte was fairly blunt in saying that a no-deal may be bad for the EU, but it would be a lot worse for the UK, and it has really diminished the UK's standing in the world, both economically and politically, whether it is a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. And I think that particular message resonated across the UK.
And as we heard to a certain extent last week, what the Dutch, who are probably the next most affected country by Brexit to Ireland in the whole scheme of things, they've priced in a no deal. Their main concern seems to be that their own business community and hauliers passing through Holland would not be at a state of readiness for a no-deal Brexit. They've mentally prepared themselves. So the leverage of the threat of no-deal coming from any potential Tory leadership candidate seems to be somewhat of a busted flush in Holland.
Yes, I mean, the Dutch have been singled out, as well as the Irish, in fact, in terms of no-deal preparation. They have recruited perhaps as many as 1,000 new customs officials for the big port of Rotterdam. And they seem to be fairly well prepared across the board. And, from experience visiting Rotterdam on the Brexit issue, a huge volume of food, refrigerated food especially, from Europe, but also from the Netherlands. They, of course, grow huge volumes of food, which has a just-in-time delivery schedule across the channel to Harwich and then into British supermarkets overnight. So that whole delivery system of fresh food that the UK supermarket system is basically founded on is entirely at risk from no deal. So that is more of a something to think about for the UK side rather than the Dutch side.
Ireland then, one of the things that was flagged at the press conference with the Taoiseach after the summit concluded today was the idea of alternative arrangements. Work is ongoing in the UK. The Taoiseach said, look, as we mentioned earlier, these aren't going to be on time, but even if they were ready, they're no replacement for the backstop. The backstop's in the withdrawal agreement. That's not being reopened. Alternative arrangements can only have an effect further down the line in the reality post-political declaration if that happens.
Yeah, I mean, this whole issue of alternative arrangements is very interesting because I suppose in parallel with the Tory leadership contest, the idea that the backstop can be straightforwardly replaced by alternative arrangements has been seized upon by some of the candidates, a lot of the commentary in the British press, that, you know, really, if the EU wants to avoid a no-deal Brexit, a damaging no-deal Brexit, alternative arrangements to replace the backstop was the way to go. Even if it wasn't a straightforward swap, then that this is really where the emphasis should be. And part of the mythology, I think, around alternative arrangements has been the Brady Amendment back in February, because he had this amendment, as you remember, whereby the backstop would be replaced by alternative arrangements, and that mythically got a majority support in the House of Commons. So the view is that if the EU wants something that Boris Johnson or whoever can get through the House of Commons, it has to be built around that.
Well, alternative arrangements, let's just delve into what that might be. Are we looking at as yet uninvented or as yet unimplemented IT solutions for border control and monitoring? Is that what they mean by that, and is that what is being suggested?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's a combination of technology and you know, border systems that, I suppose,
Max Fack in a new suit.
Yeah, I mean, Max Fack is one expression of alternative arrangements. The global customs order, if you like, is always looking for more simple, efficient ways to do stuff. We already have, you know, a lot of technology used at various borders around the world. We have the famous Norway-Sweden border, where revenue commissioners went in the very early stages of Brexit to go and look and see how that operated. You know, it involves the pre-lodging of customs declarations, the pre-notification of those declarations, the idea that you do it online before you set off with your container. Somebody somewhere in the customs world has a look at your declaration, thinks it looks okay, sends you a text message to say you're fine, then you have a barcode in your mobile phone, you pull up to a scanning machine and the bar lifts up and off you go. And that's probably as smooth as it would get in terms of technology being deployed at borders. There are other ideas which include you could have a free zone, which is permitted under EU rules and WTO rules, where goods can go in there. They don't have to be declared for customs, but they have to be presented to customs. These are somewhat nuanced differences. They exist in various parts of the world. You could have these, say, back to back along the Irish border. You could have what are called more dedicated logistics centres, where you have one-stop shop, where, you know, customs clearance can be done, animal products, live animals, food products can all be tested for sanitary and phytosanitary checks. You can make all these processes more efficient, but of course they run into the immediate problem, two big problems on the island of Ireland. One is that
you'd need a lot of them given the amount of border crossings.
Well, exactly. I mean, you have 210 border crossings. Of course, you could then have, you know, dedicated customs crossings with particular lanes and lots of cameras and scanning devices and so on. But the first main problem is that a disproportionately large section of the Northern Ireland economy is built around small, medium-sized businesses, micro-businesses with maybe 10 people involved, and a lot of those companies tend to operate in the agri-food sector and tend to operate along the border. So first of all, before these small companies even start to comprehend, you know, logistics centres or scanning machines, the tariffs alone are going to be so prohibitive that they simply won't work. It will not be economically viable for them to do this.
Well, on that, there was another intervention this week. In fact, earlier today, I think, Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, or was it late yesterday? It's hard to keep track of the time. But one of the things that's been put out by one of the Tory leadership candidates, Boris Johnson, is this Article 24 of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, that this would cover everything and that there could just be an arrangement of no tariffs between the EU and the UK in the event of no deal. Not so, says Mark Carney.
Yeah, not so, says Mark Carney. And if anybody follows Brexit on Twitter, which we all do, I mean, this is a scrap that's been going on for maybe a year. I mean, somebody somewhere had this idea that under the WTO rules, the UK and the EU would not have to apply tariffs on each other's goods for 10 years under this GATT Article 24 clause under the WTO rulebook.
But
I mean, it has been relentlessly rejected and debunked by any number of trade experts who operate in universities, on Twitter and so on. And today, as you say, Mark Carney rejected this. But Boris Johnson, who wants to be the next Prime Minister, was still of the opinion that could actually work.
In a nutshell, you can have an arrangement like that, but only if a trade agreement is near completion. And the absence of the withdrawal agreement and a future relationship decided between the European Union and the UK, that just wouldn't be in place. And the UK and the EU would have to treat each other like everywhere else, and there would have to be equal treatment under WTO rules, and they'd have to impose tariffs. That's it in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, this provision can be used in limited circumstances, but it has to be mutually agreed between both sides. So it automatically is a contradiction, because in a no-deal situation, you have no agreement between both sides, and the EU would not certainly decide to go down that road in a no-deal situation. It's pretty clear.
So where are we at the end of this summit? There's going to be another summit in a week's time. Again, not a Brexit summit, but to decide the jobs. But we'll be a bit further along with the leadership race in the UK at that stage. Who knows what might be said on the campaign trail at that point. But we're unlikely to hear anything different from EU leaders and individual heads of government as they arrive here for next week's summit than we've already. We could cut and paste what was said this week into next week. Not that we would.
Not that we would. No, I mean, I think you're right. Leaders are going to come back here Sunday, June 30th to try and get the top jobs organised. A bunch of them are going to be in Osaka in Japan at the G20, so they apparently will be having a bit of a huddle in Osaka to see if they can make any breakthroughs. But of course, in the UK, the two front runners now have to make their case to the Tory grassroots, the 160,000 or so Conservative Association members who will have the ultimate say. Now, the thing is, because they are pitching to what is perceived as a fairly uncompromising hard Brexit constituency, they may be tempted to come out with some fairly uncompromising language on Brexit, and of course that then will probably prompt some responses from the EU side and from the Taoiseach. Just one thing we probably should get into, I know you have to dash off to Luxembourg, but the European Commission published its mapping report.
Yeah, I was going to get on to that, because we talked about the backstop, but the evolution of the backstop is a lot clearer now following the publication of that, and you possibly are amongst a niche group of people who have read it in detail. So what is it?
Well, when the Brexit negotiations began in 2017, that summer with David Davis coming to Brussels, at a very early point in the process, the Irish government prompted Michel Barnier to ask the UK side to come forward with a detailed explanation of what they meant by North-South cooperation, because rhetorically, of course, the UK, Theresa May had said all along that, of course, we want to avoid a return to the hard borders of the past in Ireland. We want to protect the Good Friday Agreement. And, of course, part of the Good Friday Agreement is North-South cooperation. So that summer, 2017, British officials in Whitehall and the Northern Ireland office got together and they scanned through all of the different components of North-South cooperation as mandated by the Good Friday Agreement. Now, they came back with something like a list of 142 areas of North-South cooperation. And then what happened was British, Irish and EU officials came here to Brussels over 2 or 3 weeks and went through all of those areas of North-South cooperation to see where EU law, European policy frameworks had a relevance, where they implicitly or explicitly facilitated the conduct and the operation of that North-South cooperation. Now, a lot of this happened obviously behind closed doors, and when we then headed up to the famous joint report in December 2017, there were two abiding and urgent issues in order to protect the Good Friday Agreement. One was avoiding a hard border, so you had to make sure that there were no customs or regulatory checks at that border, but you also had to ensure that all that North-South cooperation could still operate unimpeded, given that one side of the equation in Northern Ireland, they were going to be kind of plucked out of that legal regime.
So where we arrived at in the joint report and what later went on to become the backstop was an element of design by committee there. There was, from day one, ground level ownership by British officials in designing that then. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, any of the indications that I've got, both from the Irish, British and EU side, were that the UK absolutely willingly and openly embraced this particular project to work out what North-South cooperation meant. What they probably didn't realise was that this would then feed into the very kind of urgent rationale on the Irish side to make sure that none of this would be disrupted by Brexit. I mean, I think the UK view of this was best crystallised by William Hague, the former Conservative leader, who said we should have, you know, a multiplicity of different arrangements to make sure none of these things get disrupted. The EU said that's not going to work. You need a holistic approach, and that's really what the backstop is about. So it's not just about making sure there aren't any trade or tariffs or regulatory differentials between both sides. It's also to make sure that all of those things like waterways, tourism, energy, security, higher education, health, all the health cross-border health cooperation that is facilitated by the various aspects of the Good Friday Agreement, that none of those are impeded by Brexit.
And the politics of publishing that mapping exercise now?
Well, of course, it was very interesting when it came out. Now, there is a bit of a backstory to this, because there was a request by an individual in the UK to the European Commission to publish the mapping exercise. This request went in about 18 months ago. This request first went in. The Commission replied to say, "Well, we don't really want to publish this because, first of all, it's kind of a UK document. The UK had worked up this document, so they had ownership of it. Secondly, they felt that it was probably a little bit sensitive to bring out into the public domain during the negotiations." Now, when that happened, this individual went to Emily O'Reilly, the ombudsman, the EU ombudsman here in Brussels, to make a complaint that this was against the openness and transparency of the EU. That process then got underway, and eventually the ombudsman said, "Well, okay, we accept that the Commission doesn't want to publish this during the negotiations, but when the negotiations are over, they should publish it." And now that's happened. Now, it turns out that the individual who made that particular request put in a Freedom of Information request in the UK as well, and the Cabinet Office in London actually sent this individual the overall UK report and interpretation of the mapping exercise, the 142 or 5 areas of North-South cooperation. And he in turn then sent it on to the Brexit Committee in the House of Commons, so they were going to put it on their website, and ultimately the Department of Exiting the EU put it on their website as well on Thursday. So one assumes that there wasn't it wasn't exactly a coincidence that the European Commission brought out theirs the day before, so that got out there. But I think what it really does is it reinforces this view that the backstop is not just about alleviating or obviating the need for checks and controls on trade and animal products. It's also about a whole range of North-South cooperation that cannot really be solved by technology or alternative arrangements.
It'd be wrong of us to conclude before mentioning Michel Barnier and the growing talk about him. The European People's Party, we heard from Leo Varadkar, leaving their meeting yesterday, but the name Michel Barnier keeps coming up as a potential president of the European Commission. All of the European People's Parties say, look, our Spitzenkandidat Manfred Weber is still the guy. Michel Barnier backs him. But there was a couple of things said by Leo Varadkar where he mentioned that Michel Barnier was experienced, he was aware of Irish issues, and that he'd worked very well with him before. All of those things seem to be key criteria in the selection for any job, even though Leo Varadkar was at pains to say there is no vacancy here. What are your thoughts on Michel Barnier? Why this name keeps coming up even though he's not officially a candidate?
Well, I suppose you could say that yes, his name keeps coming up, but then other names keep coming up as well. And what has made Michel Barnier interesting is the fact that yes, he commands enormous respect in the capitals. He received a standing ovation in the European Parliament at one point when he briefed MEPs on the latest stages of, or the latter stages rather, of the withdrawal agreement negotiations. He's EPP, he's French, obviously. So even though Emmanuel Macron is not on the centre-right, he's in the liberal sphere, you know, if they were to ditch Manfred Weber, then here was a ready-made candidate who was EPP but was also French, so that seemed to suggest it would be somebody that Emmanuel Macron could go for, could throw his support behind. At the same time, though, I mean, you would have to say that just in terms of this emphasis on, you know, gender and a candidate who is reflective of, you know, the current zeitgeist in terms of culture and demographics and so on. You know, he is, you know, of a certain age. He's a white male, if I can put it that way. And, you know, that may not be the signal that the EU wants to project at the moment. But, of course, a lot of the sort of worthy signals that the EU wants to project in this process tend to get whittled down when the sheer politics of this kicks in.
Well, anyway, we'll know a bit more by this time next week, and certainly by this time 2 weeks, we'll possibly have those names in the bag. Well, I suppose that's it. What's coming up in the coming week then? Is it worth looking at anything, or is it pretty much next stop, the summit?
Well, yeah, I mean, all the emphasis will be on the summit next weekend, the continuing efforts to try and find a new president for the European Commission. There is ongoing stuff on the Eurozone, but of course, as I say, all eyes will be on the two front runners in the Tory leadership race. How will they pitch and calibrate their message to the Tory grassroots, and what responses will that prompt both in Dublin, I'd say, and here in Brussels?
All right, that's our lot for this edition. From me, Colm O'Mungon in Brussels.
And from me, Tony Connolly, also in Brussels. Thanks for listening, and good luck in Luxembourg.